to another edition of the Winner's Circle interview series. And with me on the call today is Richard Cook. Richard is the author of The 80-20 Principle, and we're going to be talking about The 80-20 Principle. The subtitle is The Secret to Success by Achieving More with Less. Richard, thank you for joining my interview.
Pleasure, John.
Richard, before we get kicked off, maybe you should set a little background and tell everybody about yourself and how you came to write this 80-20 principle book.
Sure, John. I'm someone who used to be a strategic consultant, and one of the things which I came across as a strategy consultant was something that I'd actually read about originally when I was in university a long time ago, which is the 80-20 principle. And I'd always found it very useful, not only in business but in life as well. So one day I actually got round to writing a book about it, and I've turned myself into a business author, and probably spend about three quarters of my professional time on that. I've stopped being a management consultant. I've seen the light, and the rest of my time I get involved as a very active entrepreneur stroke investor. Again, attempting to apply the principle. I don't get involved in any of the very difficult business of managing a company, which anyway would be way beyond my capabilities, but I do get involved in investing in the company, selecting the key executives and working with them to try and identify how we can have fantastic returns in a very few business segments.
Richard, what is the, in simplest terms, what is the 80-20 principle? And I know it's called by a lot of different names, but so what in the simplest terms is it? And give a little bit of a background, if you would.
Yeah, it was invented about 100 years ago, just over 100 years ago, by an Italian economist, Vilfredo Pareto. And as you say, it's known by many, many names, John. And the Pareto rule, I think, used to be the principal one. But in recent years, more and more people have used the 80-20 principle because it provides a very snappy encapsulation of a very typical relationship where you have 20% of causes leading to 80% of results. And the basic idea behind it is very, very simple, which is if you can identify the few causes which are very, very powerful, the 20%, whether it's 5%, 1%, 10%, 20%, 30%, really doesn't matter. But the few causes which are going to lead to the great majority of results, whether that's 70, 80, 99, or whatever percent, then obviously by focusing on those, you can increase your effectiveness and you can increase your cash or profits or happiness or whatever is your objective very, very dramatically. The basic idea is that life isn't really the total or the average of what we observe. Life divides into some things which are fantastically important in terms of producing results and a lot of things which are not at all important. So the key is really to separate out the very few things which matter and the majority of things which don't matter. Now, most of us would say, yeah, well, that's obvious that some things are more important than others, and in many ways it is very obvious. But we always underestimate the extent to which that's true. For example, with the profitability of customers or products, yeah, we always know that there are some products or customers that are very much more important than others. But if we stop to think or test the idea that 20% actually deliver 80% of results, that would say, well, what the hell are we doing with the 80%? Why are we bothering with the vast majority of our activity? So it poses questions which you can then answer either intuitively or quantitatively in order to improve things. The whole point about the 80-20 principle is getting more with less, that less in certain circumstances can be more. And therefore, if you demand more with less, you're actually bound to make a very, very major improvement. Whereas if you just try and get a little bit more with a little bit more effort or money or cash or whatever, then you're going to find yourself making incremental improvements, which won't take a great leap forward. But I have to say that the most succinct definition of the 80-20 principle was one which you mentioned to me a couple of weeks ago, which is five people sit down to poker, and one of them will walk away with 80% or more of the pot. Which I think is a very, very neat way of encapsulating it.
Well, and again, it shows my, you know, some of my background and where I was originally, unlike you, I was introduced to this not through the university, but through professional gambling. And these people were very pragmatic. They were not interested at all in, a theory, if you will, because the theory was going to be tested that day, and it was going to be tested with real money called a bankroll. And if it failed, one would not eat. And it was pretty interesting, because part of it was discerning what part of you, what you needed to know to be able to play the game well enough to be able to extract wealth from the others. And in fact, it distilled to this one simple rule, and you may have heard this or may not have, but it came down to, you always need to find someone you can beat and go out there and seek games in which you have a superiority in some way or some fashion, and never try to go beyond your skill level. So you essentially want to dominate a lesser crowd is the way it works out. And it was a good application of it, and it helped me out a lot through my business and sales career.
That's a very interesting one. And in a way, that the most important thing in poker then is not the the skill with which you play, but selecting the players that you play with.
That's absolutely correct. And in fact, it's one of those things that I've taught it over the years to people. I said, if you want to teach anything to your children, it's have them select games or a skill, or have them select a situation in which they emphatically can win and win consistently. And it is psychologically difficult for humans to do that, because we're trained from a very young age to always seek a greater and greater and greater challenge. You see this with companies that are very successful and niche, and they say, if we could only get to this expansive large market, it's disaster, because it's a little bit like having a nice secure tugboat that works well in the harbor and the channel, and say, well, now we're going to take it out onto the big ocean, and you find out that it was never designed to do it.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, to take the illustration of individual abilities, we have a sense in which we think we ought to be all-rounders. We think that we have to be good at everything. Whereas the most successful people in life are people who are very, very unbalanced people. They're very lopsided. They have tremendous strength in one or two areas. And they utilize the strength in those areas. And they just don't care about their weaknesses. They let other people clear up around them. Whether with people or with companies, I think it's exactly the same thing, that the beginning of wisdom is to understand what it is that you're extraordinarily good at, and make that even better and better and better, and gain more and more experience in the very narrow area where you in fact can excel, and just don't worry about the other things.
And that so much, Richard, flies in the face of so much dogma, and I call it that specifically, so much of the dogma that exists today, in which we're telling people, we want you to lead a balanced life, and we want you to have, you know, here's the nine different aspects of your life, and apportion all the time, and do all of these things. Essentially, to me, I view those as total diffusion of your capabilities.
They're a denial of individuality at the end of the day. I mean, isn't it weird that you know, we accept in our culture that individuality is very important, and personal differences are very, very important, and yet we spend most of our lives trying to be exactly the same as everybody else, whereas what we should really be doing is accentuating the differences, because the only way that progress is made, in my view, is through people becoming different and doing different things. And the difference between human beings and other animals is that human beings have got the capability to an extraordinarily higher degree to be individuals and to be different from the rest of the breed. And that's true of companies. It's true of people as well.
Why do you think it's so hard to accept this unbalanced version of the universe? Is it because it's counterintuitive? But I've just noticed resistance in my own consultant practice and dealing with training individuals and training companies. Why do you think it's so hard to accept the 80-20 principle?
Well, I think there are at least three reasons. One is that it flies in the face of our culture, which is a liberal democratic culture. And it seems unfair and inegalitarian. It seems as though it's a fundamentally elitist view, which I don't think it is, actually. But the idea that one should concentrate on differences is perhaps something which doesn't sound as though it fits in with our sort of cultural biases. I think the second reason is that, as we go through life, we're just not trained to notice what's different about the really successful things. or the really effective things. You know, life is a conspiracy to confuse us in many ways, because there's so much going on that it is quite difficult to say, well, I'm not actually going to take any notice of 80% or 90% of what's going on. I'm actually going to try and reduce my experience and the things that I use as allies or weapons or tools for me and my own abilities to a very small proportion of the total. We kind of expect psychologically that, you know, results are not tremendously lopsided or not tremendously unbalanced. And we, you know, our whole way of thinking is much more driven towards the bell curve than it is towards the 80-20 phenomenon. Now, the bell curve certainly applies to certain things in life, such as intelligence, but it doesn't apply to results. When you come down to results, it's always a very, very lopsided distribution where very few people or very few forces actually have the vast preponderance of results. You know, whether you're talking about a few clouds in the sky that will deliver most of the rain, or you're talking about a very small proportion of the Earth's surface which will deliver the vast majority of mineral wealth, or actually whether you're talking about people in a company. You can observe this empirically with selling. I mean, it's definitely true that some salespeople sell very much more than others do. The third reason why I think that we don't use the 80-20 principle as much as we ought to is because we like complexity. And particularly managers and engineers, especially prone to this, actually like variety and complexity in their work and go out of their way to deal with the most intricate and difficult problems in life. And I think that ordinary people do this as well, that we concentrate on the problems in life and we don't concentrate on the opportunities, because in many ways the problems are more interesting and they're certainly more difficult. Whereas to actually simplify things down to the essentials does go against our intellectual curiosity in many ways, I think. So there are all sorts of reasons why we don't tend to look at it this way, but I think it's just that we're not used to having counterintuitive things be correct. We're used to our intuition being correct. And one of our strong instincts, which probably derives from early days when we were hunter-gatherers, is to observe all experience around us, because if you miss some experience, you know, you may end up being dead. Well, modern life isn't really like that. Modern life is a lot more complex and differentiated, and it pays to focus on a very small part of existence rather than the whole of it.
Does the 80-20 principle apply to everything? I just, when I read your book and I saw how many places you applied it, I mean, I've applied it specifically in gambling and sales and marketing and in my investments. I've applied it those places. But you gave such a broad range of things. Do you think that it's so endemic, inherent, that it applies to everything?
Well, it applies to everything, John, when you actually want to get results and you're thinking about how to get results. It doesn't apply to some phenomena. I mean, intelligence is a very good example of that. You know, it isn't true that 20% of people have 80% of intelligence. That's clearly not true. I mean, even Albert Einstein probably only had an IQ of 250 or 300 or something like that. So he was two or three times the average. Whereas the 80-20 principle actually implies that there's a difference between the top group, the 20%, which produces 80, produces on average 4 units, and the bottom group, which is 80 people, produces 20 units, which is a quarter of a unit each. And the difference, obviously, between producing 4 units in the top group and producing a quarter of the units in the bottom group is a difference of 16 times, which is 4 divided by 0.25. So, you know, if one's talking about a difference of 16 times, it beggars belief in many ways. And it certainly doesn't apply to something like intelligence. But if you ask the question differently and say, what is the relevant phenomenon when we're talking about wealth creation, then it obviously is true that there are some people who, despite not being more than twice as intelligent or talented as other people, do produce results which are 16 times, 100 times, or in Bill Gates' case, sort of zillions of times more effective in terms of producing wealth than most other people. So I don't think it applies to all phenomena, but I do think it applies to anything where you're saying to what causes a result. If you're interested in results such as wealth creation or selling or marketing or any other objective such as being happy or making money or whatever, then it does apply. I've never known an area where if you sit and think about it, it isn't possible to isolate a very, very small number of incredibly powerful forces on the one hand and the vast majority of forces on the other, which are not terribly effective. In other words, there is always a way to do something much, much more effectively, which is, you know, not just twice as good or three times as good, but 10 or 20 times as good. There is always a way to get more with less. And the whole history of progress in the world, I believe, follows from this thing. It's very unreasonable people trying to work out how we can get something which is hugely greater in terms of its value and output and actually uses fewer resources. So if you take the contrast between modern agriculture and agriculture 300 years ago, you know, it used to be true that 98% of people had to live on the land, and we were very lucky if we managed to feed everyone. Today, we have something like 2 or 3% in the developed world who actually work in agriculture, and they produce hundreds of times more food than was actually produced 300 years ago relative to any particular measure.
So are you saying then that all of these farm programs are almost misguided, because when all these farm programs are trying to stop the ever-deteriorating number of farmers in the developed world, in essence, what they're doing is that they're really fighting against a trend which has been going on for 300 years, which is the 80-20 principle is tracking, and we're getting much higher output for very little input or much smaller input. And in essence, this is really a ridiculous misuse of government money. I know this is a little bit of a discursion, but I mean,
I think it's absolutely true. I mean, if you just look at it from the point of view of economic objectives, it's ludicrous, absolutely ludicrous. But if you look at it from the point of view of, for example, in France, you know, they like the idea of preserving French culture and all the rest of it. Well, you can make a very feeble case for something like that. But I mean, if you're interested in results and feeding people, then obviously it's a very silly way of doing it.
Well, I think that's really a good way to put it. And one of the things that I would point out that I hear you saying over and over again in your book, and Richard, it's a fantastic book. I mean, I'm a raving fan. Is what I hear you saying over and over again is you really don't have to work harder. I've got a lot of coaching clients, a lot of consulting clients, and the first place they always start is, well, we're going to roll up our sleeves and we're all going to put in twice as much or four times as much effort, and these people are working themselves to death. And I say, wait a second, I think you're misapplying what, you know, the lesson. The lesson isn't to work more, it's to work better. Maybe you can loop back into that.
Yes, I mean, I think that there are many, many people in the world who've decided that they're going to work harder, and it's just not a comparative advantage. I mean, all we've done in the last 40 or 50 years is actually stress people out and take more and more time from people's personal lives, family lives, social lives, and so on and so forth, and work becomes the overwhelming priority. But that confers no advantage to the people who follow that route. Ultimately, I believe it's very destructive because they can't, or at least it's much more difficult under those circumstances to be extremely creative. The whole point is to try and find a way of doing something which is a huge step function improvement. And if you put more resources into something, what you're really saying is that, but all that we can accept is a small incremental improvement. The only way to get more is to put more in. Whereas, again, the whole history of progress is putting less in and getting more out. So you have to demand something that is less intensive of time, energy, resources, money, and which, on the other hand, gives a hugely better result. And if you think about any of the great success stories of the 20th century, like computers, for example, you see that's just a story of unending getting more for less. You for less money, less space, less time, less professional training, and so on and so forth, you actually get more and more out. Computer becomes smaller and smaller, costs less and less, takes fewer and fewer resources, including, whether people are trained technicians or just people like me who, basically have no idea what's going on inside the computer. You get a fantastic advance from doing that. Whereas if you say, well, we've always got the luxury of putting more time in or more money in, at the very best, you're going to end up with something which is slightly better than today. Well, what you've actually got to do is to be very, very radical. I always like the story about American, forgive me if they were American, but visiting physicists who saw Ernest Rutherford in the 1930s, and they went to his university labs in Cambridge, and they were appalled at how primitive machinery was. And they said to him, really, don't you think you should spend some more money or get some more money from the university for your facilities, because we have to tell you that they're nowhere near as good as ours. And he said, it's true that we don't have much money, so what we have to do is to think. And, if you've got too much of one particular resource, then it's very, very, it's very harmful in many ways. And I think venture capital is another great example of that, that actually the businesses that get funded by venture capitalists are those that really have at least the chance of producing a huge improvement. And why is that true? Because venture capitalists are greedy bastards and they want 30% return each year or whatever it is. What that means is that unless you've got something which is a dramatic improvement, you're just not going to get funded, or at least offers the possibility of producing a huge result. And it's the same thing. If we think that we just put more time into something and somehow we'll make a major improvement, we're just deluding ourselves. What we need to do is to find a solution which requires less time but offers a much better result. We need to think a little bit about what's really important before we actually waste our energy trying to do things.
So let's take a more specific direction. How does it apply to marketing? Let's start with marketing and then we'll step into sales. But how does it apply to marketing and how you can improve your marketing and get this tremendous leverage up?
I think it goes back to the things that you were talking about earlier, John. I mean, the first question is, what are you going to market? What is it that you have to offer? And that's a question of trying to work out what you are exceptionally good at doing, which, is a question of either product or technology or skills or whatever. But why amongst all the other people in the world and the other companies in the world do you have a role? What is it that you are incredibly good at doing? Because you can be sure that there are some things where you're just average or below average that you're doing at the moment. But what is it? What's the secret that actually says, well, we managed to have a reasonable existence? So look at the things that you do exceptionally well. Try and work out what's exceptionally profitable. Try and work out what produces a huge result for a relatively small input of cash or time or skill or whatever. You may be surprised at that. It's really a question of first of all, not thinking about how you're going to market or even what you're going to market, but why the company exists, what its competitive advantage can be. And in doing that, you should think very modestly and very small about, what is it where we are exceptionally successful.
And I know you talk a lot about doing segmentation of markets and segmentation of products, and maybe you can talk a little bit about how that would apply also.
Yeah, I mean, what you need to do is to say, well, let's break down the market into as many segments as we can possibly think of, and then say, well, which areas are we most profitable in? And don't use the categories that market researchers use. Don't look at demographics. And I've never found demographics, off-the-shelf demographics anyway, particularly insightful. You might have a particular bias towards women or people of a certain age or whatever, or people of a certain class. But actually, you need to be much more creative about thinking which type of customers do we really serve, or which type of customers are the ones that are exceptionally profitable. I mean, my experience was in management consulting, and it was quite interesting in management consulting that in the 1970s there was one company which was far more profitable than all the others, whereas McKinsey would be happy with something like a 10 or 15% return on sales. There was a company called Bain & Company, which initially was a very, very small company, which actually had a return on sales of 40% or more. Now, you know, what was it that they were doing differently? You know, were they focusing on particular industries? Were they focusing on particular products? What was it? What was the magic? That their product was actually very similar to that of the Boston Consulting Group, which maybe had a return on sales of 20%. Not surprising it was the same Boston Consulting Group, because it was founded, Bain & Company was founded by people who left BCG and took exactly the same products and methodologies and ways of approaching strategy as BCG had had. So they had no advantage there. They had no advantage in terms of reputation. But Bill Bain was an extraordinarily clever guy, and what he did was to work out the type of customer that he should approach. And his view was that the very, very profitable customers were actually the chief executives of whole groups, and that you could do exactly the same work for the head of marketing or the head of international or the head of some particular product category or division as for the group chief executive. But the value of that work could be hugely greater if you were working with a group chief executive, because he had the power and the money to make sure that what you recommended had results. And so if you focused all of your work in terms of the segment, if you defined your segment as actually the chief executive of a group, then in fact you could have a fantastically profitable business, and you could grow at something like 40% a year or more than that, by segmenting the market in a way that no one had ever thought of before. Although, like all great segmentations, once you sit and think about it and you've heard it, you think, well, of course that's going to be true. But it wasn't worked out by any other consulting firm in the world until Bain & Company came along with that very novel way of thinking about the segmentation. And what it did, and the test of a very good piece of segmentation, is always, what does it cut out? If it doesn't cut out very much business, it's not a very good or creative form of segmentation. If, on the other hand, it says 80% or more of what you're doing or what the industry is doing is a waste of time, then that is a very useful piece of segmentation. And I remember in the early days of Bain & Company that some of Bain's colleagues, who many of whom became ex-colleagues before too long, would say to him, Bill, this is crazy. You know, you're asking us to cut out, you know, the vast majority of work that Boston Consulting Group or McKinsey does. You're asking us to stop working for all these people further down in the organization. And can that possibly be a sensible strategy? Particularly as we're very short of work. I mean, in the early days, Bain & Company, found it very difficult to scrabble together enough work to keep even a very small number of professionals busy. But Bill's reply was, you know, we're not going to get a reputation for being different unless we really are different. And we're not going to be different if we take any old work that comes along just because we want to keep our consultants billable. So what we need to do is to establish our reputation. And then we can say, honestly, people, there is no other consulting firm in the world which refuses to work for other people. And therefore, we can be totally distinctive. So it's that kind of very radical segmentation, which I think is always the route to success. And you're not going to get a definition like that from your standard market research.
Well, and it's interesting because I've often been on the sales side, working for startup and high tech companies, and have run into the marketing strategic guy. I mean, you know, by the way, the word strategic has a real bad, you know, connotation in my mind because I'm always fighting these guys. And what I would do is I would say, look, let's go after fewer targets and let's go after bigger fish.
Yeah.
And it was interesting because I helped a company get to the Inc. 500, position number 18. And I mean, you know, I'm a poster child for your book. Is that I did 35% of the gross of the business, but I did 75% of the profits for this business,
yeah,
year in and year out, and I was constantly being berated because I didn't have enough customers, and you think about it and you go, well, wait a second, how are we not having enough customers here? I'm doing huge profits out of these customers, and the profits are what fuels any business. And so how do you deal with when you run into the, if you will, the mindset problem of, you know, throwing out all these supposed customers?
Well, I think that you, one way of dealing with that is to work out the profitability on a fully costed basis and to just run the numbers. I mean, even if you don't do it precisely in the way that an accountant would do, if you just make some rough and ready assumptions, then I think you can say, well, if it really is true that 20% of our business is producing 80% of our results, what would happen if we just concentrated on trying to serve those customers and sold more to them or found other customers who were very, very similar to those customers? Again, one of the things you mentioned, which I think is terribly important, is making sure that you get a hell of a lot of business with the people that you are already having a lot of success with. And, you know, it's not an accident. You might not know why, but it's not an accident if you're extremely profitable with a customer. What it means is, even though either the customer or you may not quite work it out, what you're providing is ideal for them. Because otherwise, you wouldn't be able to make a lot of money, and they wouldn't be happy. So when you see a customer who's buying more and more from you, your reaction shouldn't be, oh, my God, this can't last, let's diversify. Your reaction should be, shit, this is wonderful. Let's try and sell more and more and more to this particular customer, because there's something that we're doing right about this. There's something right in the relationship between what he wants and what we can provide. And one category to think about very, very carefully is your existing customers who are very, very profitable. In consulting, exactly what you say applied, John, that you found all the excitement, all the interest was in who's going to be the new client, you know, who's going to be the next major account that we managed to crack. Whereas in Bain & Company, and later in my own firm, we had a different philosophy, which was let's sell more to the existing customers. Let's make sure that the existing customers are very successful and that we can justify a very, very high return on the work which we do for those customers. And then let's take the amount we sell to those customers up, you know, not just by 10% a year, but by 100% a year or 300% a year or 400% a year, because we're doing something which is highly profitable for both parties. So focusing on existing customers who are very profitable is a terrific way to growing. And instead of costing you money, which is what many people say market development does, it can actually make you a lot of money at the same time.
Well, and I can't agree with you more. When I was doing sales turnarounds, the first thing I would do to get a huge bump is I would say, let's take all of your customers by dollar volume, by profit. Let's put together those lists. Let's take the top five, then the next five, then the next five, then the next five. And in order, let's go see those customers. And anybody below a certain threshold, I just said, let's write them off. Let's go give them to somebody else. And in fact, advocated, especially low volume or low or high expense customers, you know, you're doing volume, but it's costing you a lot of money, is to literally sell them to your competition.
Yeah.
Just sit there and say, look, we're going to walk away from this opportunity anyway. Can we get some money? Can we get some kind of dollars back out of this thing by selling them literally to our competition? I got to tell you, I had screaming matches in I wasn't doing the screaming. The client was saying, you've got to be out of your mind. Why? We fought hard to get this client. And I said, you're losing money every year. So what you're saying is you want to make that up in volume. It just doesn't work. And to me, that was an application of how I did it. I wasn't doing the in-depth analysis that you're describing. I was doing it more of a, you know, it just made sense to me. You take the top 20 customers that you're doing business with, you go back and you try to do more business with them. And one of the things that we did is we tried to invent things to do for those customers that nobody else in the world was going to do, such as helping them get more business was an example of what we did. And it was amazing because they ended up, you know, making this a partnership, and it kept growing from that point.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with that more. To give your unprofitable customers to your competition, you win so many different ways. I mean, for one thing, you divert their energy away from trying to take your best customers away, or to win new customers in the market as a whole. Secondly, you make sure that those companies are not going to have the resources for future market or product development, because you give them unprofitable customers, they're going to lose money on those customers, whatever they think. so you differentiate yourself that way. You can also make a quick buck by selling the customers, and you avoid head-to-head competition because they become more and more specialized in a bad part of the market, and you become more and more specialized in a good part of the market.
Oh, absolutely. How do you apply it to your personal life? Because I noticed that you took it in a direction which I had not even really explored fully, but you talk about it in the book, The 80-20 Principle, is you talk about how to use it also in your personal life.
Well, exactly the same considerations apply. You can look at it in terms of, first of all, I think you have to start with your own abilities and inclinations and say, what's really important to me in life? If you're very clear about what's important to you in life, then in fact you can stop doing a lot of things which in fact are unnecessary for advancing those particular purposes. All of us do a lot of things which don't produce the results we want, but we just can carry on doing them. A lot of the things that we do actually subtract value. So if you have an objective, for example, that you want to deepen your romantic relationship, then, you know, it's very easy to say, well, what are the few things that actually are very important to the other party? If you stop to think about it that way, you rapidly discover that an awful lot of things that you do have very little result or negative results. And you can focus on doing more of the things that are important to your partner from that point of view. So you know, that's one way that you can deal with it. But it's exactly the same methodology. You say in many ways less is more. Less is more when you divide the world and the things that you do into the things which are very important to you and the things which are not. And you basically disregard the things that are unimportant, and the few things that are important, you do more of them, or you put more energy into that. But that's not falling into this trap of working harder or trying to improve yourself in lots and lots of different dimensions. You can actually make less effort and spend less time on something if you cut out a huge number of things where you say, these things are just not important to me. And you know, there are many activities which ordinary people engage in which are just not satisfying. And if they stop to think about it, they'll discover that they aren't satisfying. I mean, watching television is a great example. Even reading newspapers can be a great example. You know, it's just not necessary to keep up to date with the news. If there's anything that's really important to you in your area, you'll know about it. But other people will tell you if the world's about to come to an end or something like that.
Well, and let me jump in. One of the things that I recommend to most of my coaching clients is to in a lot of ways, stop taking the newspaper because they spend a lot of time every morning feeding their minds with all of the, if you will, the sensational, all the problems that exist. You know, the economy is going to come to an end. The world is going to stop spinning. All of those things are constantly being harangued because that's how newspapers sell newspapers. And I say to people, look, if you really want to know what's going on, go to a clipping service and pay a clipping service and get information about what you're specifically interested. The internet gives you a wonderful way to do that. But get out of your head of listening to all of the craziness that goes on in the world, because you know what? With 6 billion people, there's bound to be a lot of craziness going on at any given day.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. You just want to focus on the things that are important to you and the opportunities, and there are always opportunities, and there are always things that you can do. Why worry about things that you can't control? And if you think about it, the vast majority of what goes on in the world, either you can't control or you don't want to control, or both.
Well, and I think that's a great way to apply that. And as you're saying, you're really talking about willful neglect. You're really saying, look, you know, if you can't affect it, if it doesn't really affect you today, if it really isn't in your world, then cut it out of your world. Don't even carry that baggage around. You don't need to worry about whether or not there's a certain disease going on if it doesn't affect you or if it isn't your neck of the woods, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, there are people whose job it is to deal with that.
Oh, and in this world, we have lots of people who are worried about those things. So in essence, let them worry about it and let you get on with the business of having a better life. How would you apply it to decision-making, the 80-20 principle?
Well, again, I think that there are a very few decisions that you make each week or each year or each day which are important. And the most crucial thing is to try and work out what those are. I mean, for example, in your work, you know, you probably make lots and lots of decisions each week, but on a Monday morning, it's a very, very good discipline, or on a Sunday afternoon, to actually sit down and think, what are the one or two decisions that I'm going to make this week, which are so different in terms of their ramifications and their value, you know, the value if I get it right or the danger if I get it wrong. What are the one or two decisions that I'm going to make? And then what are all the other decisions that I'm proposing to make? And then just say, well, let's not worry about all those other decisions. Let's let other people decide those, or let them get decided by events. But let me focus on paying a lot more attention in preparing and thinking about the one or two things which are crucially important. And again, in life, you know, there are some things which actually determine your happiness to an extraordinary degree. And yet, the amount of time and effort and thought that goes into it can be, you know, no more than the time and effort and thought that goes into something which is relatively trivial. The best example, of course, is your selection of a life partner, your spouse or whatever. You know, I'm always amazed at how people actually tend to gravitate towards people that they work with or people who live very locally. You know, despite the fact the world is a very, very big place these days, it is statistically highly probable that you will somehow end up married to someone who either you work with or who lives within a relatively small radius of where you live. And that's not necessarily indicative of a great deal of careful thought and proactive investigation into whom you might have as your life partner. You know, there are just some decisions which are so hugely important that one just needs to pay more attention to them. And then with those decisions, when you've isolated the decision which is extraordinarily important, you then have to say, how can I get much more for much less? Again, it's this principle of progress which says, you know, I don't want to make a decision which is just marginally better than another decision. How could I make a decision which is actually going to have a dramatically better output in terms of whatever is important to me, whether it's money or happiness or whatever, and which is going to cause me much less money, cost me much less money, cause me much less aggravation, and, you know, into which I will not have to put enormous effort. And again, in terms of personal relationships, the answer is that you've got to find someone who actually, through some quirk of their own personality, likes you a great deal, that it's very easy to please them.
Right.
Whereas a lot of people end up married to people that actually, you know, you have to say they have to work incredibly hard just to get a very mediocre result in terms of the quality of the relationship.
Well, and in fact, what you just described, I think, is, it just struck me as you can actually probably build a key company person retaining key employees. Through what you just described, is sitting down. I've seen a lot of people, myself included, who've jumped around in industry, essentially to all the various players, and made more or less lateral moves, but no one ever sat down and said, look, you know, is this really significantly better, or are you just going to get a marginal improvement? And if you're just going to get a marginal improvement, why don't we just make it here and you don't have to go anywhere?
Yeah.
I mean, what you just described is that's very intriguing. I'm going to think about that.
The key is to be incredibly demanding and unreasonable and say, you know, how can things be so much better than they are today? How can I get much more for much less? Because there is an answer. You know, if it's important enough to get the answer, you will get the answer. And as long as you say, you know, we want something which is a quite unreasonable improvement, you know, an insanely great product, as Steve Jobs used to say. You know, how can we come up with something which is so extraordinarily better than what we've got at the moment? And how can we do that not by putting enormous effort into it, but by being lazy? You know, how can we do that elegantly and simply and, you know, with great economy?
That's an interesting way to put it. I like that. a couple more things. I mean, we're rolling up against a time window here. A couple more things are in your book. You talk about how the 80-20 principle is both strategic and nonlinear.
Yes, nonlinear again is this idea that things somehow are not equivalent, that causes and results can be very, very divorced from each other. And it's quite related to the ideas from chaos theory. The idea that a butterfly flapping its wings can cause a hurricane, you know, thousands of miles away or whatever. We're just not attuned to the thought that some big results can actually occur from relatively small causes. And so therefore it behoves us to think, you know, what small causes could actually lead to huge results. And a good example of a feedback loop like that is a microphone, which picks up a very small amount of sound in an auditorium and then actually magnifies it to an extraordinary degree. Or money, you know, I mean, it's a proven fact that the only way to get rich, unless you happen to be very lucky in a lottery, or you happen to marry someone who's very rich and so on, is actually to save money, you know, and to save a small proportion of your income each year and then to invest that, because compound interest will then do the rest. That is an extremely nonlinear system. And some people end up with a vast majority more money than other people. But it has a very, very simple root cause behind it. So whenever you see extraordinary results, don't think necessarily that there's an extraordinary cause behind it. It might be a very simple one. Just understand what the causes are that actually produce extraordinary results. As Warren Buffett says, it's not necessary to do extraordinary things to get extraordinary results. You know, there are in any business, whether it's making money or selling products or anything at all, there are usually some very simple rules which account for success. And all you have to do is to work out what those rules are and then follow them.
How would you say that you would, you know, that was actually feeds into the next thing, which is making money. How would you apply it to making money for your own business, or if you're working for somebody? And by the way, the last line in your book, which I absolutely just, I love it. It says, you don't have to wait for anyone else to apply the 80-20 principle, which I think is really worth repeating, is you don't have to wait for anyone else to apply it to your own life, to your own circumstance. So many people are waiting for, if you will, validation, or, you know, the stars have to line up. I think that is very crucial, and I just wanted to get that on the table. But how do you apply it to money making when you're, you know, I mean, you talked about it a little bit, but, you know, let's dig in a little bit deeper.
Well, I think you have to say, well, how do people get rich, first of all? Well, people don't get rich by working for other people. I mean, that's absolutely clear. You can be a very highly paid employee, but what tends to happen is because you're working so hard, you tend to spend a lot of money as well. So you don't actually get rich from doing that. You get rich by having an idea. You get rich by starting a business. You get rich by being a partner of someone who's had a bright idea. You get rich by basically having something which is growing very, very fast and which is one of the very few ideas which is so much more successful than other ideas. So if your objective is to make money, it's absolutely apparent that what you should aim to do is to be in business for yourself as quickly as possible. But to be in business for yourself is not a sufficient condition. It's probably a necessary condition for being rich, but it's not a sufficient condition. And in order to be successful, you have to come up with an idea which is going to make an extraordinarily high return, so that there's plenty of room for your capital backers to make money and for you also to have a significant chunk of the equity. And that means that you have to work out how to do something that other people are doing, which is so much better. Very often, though, what you can do is take an idea from one industry and apply it to another. It so happens that I'm an investor at the moment in something called a betting exchange. Now, the idea of a betting exchange is that you cut out the bookmaker. Instead of having an intermediary taking between 10 and 20% of the amount that's gambled, what you do is you put individuals together so that they can make bets with each other. You provide a market whereby they bet with each other. You take no risk at all, and you're standing as a broker in the middle taking 1% or whatever. And there's a company based in England, which is gambling capital of the world, I suppose, which in the last 2 years has done that and now has an amazing business, which is hugely profitable and still growing at 10% a month. And I'm a significant shareholder in this business. It's called Betfair, and it's a betting exchange. The guy who invented the betting exchange is a guy called Andrew Black, who like you, John, you know, had a career, part-time career in gambling and in playing poker. And he was just thinking one day, why can't we apply to gambling exactly the same principle that the stock exchange is based on? And it's just, you know, it's a broking business. You know, why can't we enable individuals to basically contract with each other to gamble in the same way that one person or institution will buy shares and another one will sell shares, and the broker stands in the middle making a liquid market? And that's all it is. It's just a very, very simple idea. But Andrew Black already has made tens of millions of dollars out of that idea just by selling a very small amount of his company. And it's a fantastic idea. So the key thing is to work out how you're going to be in business. And the secret to that is actually to come up with an idea which is hugely powerful. And to do that, you don't have to come up with a new idea. Just apply an existing mega successful idea in a different industry. And, you know, you can probably list on the fingers of two hands what are the mega successful ideas in business. They're things like markets, which is a variant of what I was just talking about. They're things like broking, which again is what I was just talking about. They're things like self-service, you know, getting the customer to do more of the work and enabling you to take cost out, and in many cases to make it better for the customer because they have more influence on the outcome. There are a handful of business ideas which are amazingly powerful. Take one of those business ideas or take two of them and combine them into a new business.
And I would point out, Richard, that I mean, self-service is on one side of the coin. The other side of the coin is doing it all for them. And yep. that there's money to be made on both sides. I very much tell my clients and my consulting customers that what they want to do is if you can't get your customers the self-service model, because that may be the lower margin end, you may want to then do the elite side. You may want to do it all for them from cradle to grave and provide them with so much service that you can charge extraordinary amounts of money and get away with it, because people, they are inherently lazy. I don't know if you've... I'll give you an example. My favorite lazy thing in the United States is that there's a company called Smucker's. They do jellies and things like that. And what they do is they pre-make peanut butter and jelly sandwiches without the crust, and they freeze them in little plastic bags. So that way mothers and fathers don't have to make these. That, you know, it's so onerous to take two slices of bread and a couple of spoons and a knife and spread out the peanut butter and the jelly and then put these two things together and stick it in a plastic bag. It's so onerous to do that they have people paying premium pricing to do that for them. And then what you do is you take this out and you drop it in little Billy or little Sally's lunch pail. They take it to school, and by the time they get to that lunch period, it's thawed out. I mean, and they're charging premium prices. They are, and that's the opposite side of self-serve.
I know we have to close in a moment, John.
Sure.
That very example raises two other excellent generic points, I think. One is Niels Bohr, the quantum physicist, said something which I think every marketer, every business person can actually take great advantage from, which he said, the opposite of a great truth is another great truth. So if you see anything that's very successful, just try and work out what the complete opposite of that is, and you might very well have a success as well, because that will appeal to a different market segment. The other observation is that very often you can have a huge success by just cutting something out. I mean, if you think about something like the Sony Walkman, I mean, the Sony Walkman is basically a CD system which doesn't have amplifiers and one or two other things. And yet, by cutting down the size and by cutting out one element of the system, you have a whole fantastic new way of listening to music, which is very valuable. You know, a great martini can be made by cutting out the martini. There very often there's a way to adding more value by subtracting something, and you end up with something which is a completely different application.
Well, I'd like to close with just one final piece that I read in your book, which I think is fascinating, which is making a top 20 relationships list, and how that might apply. Let me first give a little setup to it. This top 20 list is, think of all the relationships you have and looking for what you're looking for is most important ones. And I really think this is a very powerful concept. And what I would suggest to people is, you can put people on this relationship list that you don't necessarily know right now. But why don't you explain it from your perspective?
I've forgotten the particular point which I was making there. It's a while since I read it. Maybe you could make the point for me.
Oh, all right. Well, okay. So what you were talking about is how important that you put together what's called a top 20 personal relationships chart. And that you need to think in terms of who out in the universe, I mean, 6 billion people, that could help you get this enormous leverage and in your business, in your personal life, in your whatever.
Yeah. I mean, I remember the idea now. Yeah. I mean, it's really specifying the ideal relationships. Again, we get power from cooperating with other people. I mean, one of the big differences between the world 100 years ago, when everyone was locked up in their individual corporations and basically you didn't talk to anyone outside your own corporation, is these days it's so easy to cooperate with people, and there are a few people in the world who can give you an enormous boost and your business an enormous boost. Work out who those few people are and then do whatever is necessary to get them on your side, and that way you can multiply your power enormously. But don't go for someone who, you know, is your first choice. Really think very, very long and hard about who the key allies could be, because there's probably one or two or three of those who can give you 10 or 20 times more than anybody else, because of the peculiar character that they are and the peculiar character that your business is.
Well, Richard Cook, this has been an absolute delight. And for those of you, because we didn't allude to this, I'm sitting in Southern California, and Richard is sitting in Spain, enjoying hopefully beautiful weather there, like I am here in Southern California. Richard, the book, The 80-20 Principle, is an outstanding book. I recommend it to all my clients, to all my listeners. I have to say to people, this is an absolute bargain. For basically $16 US, this is a tremendous way to improve your business and your life. Richard, thank you for taking the time and sharing with my listeners in the Winner Circle. You are definitely a winner. I'd love to hear more about some of your other business ideas. Thank you very much for your time.
That's a great pleasure, and I'm all in favor of winners. So go and win more, win big, guys. Thanks very much indeed for your time.
Thank you.
Bye-bye now.